Today's Tay Show is on case 86 in the Pien Lu, the Heikigan Roku. Case 86 is Umon's Everybody Has His Own Light. Engo's introduction, controlling the world, he allows not the least speck of dust to escape. He cuts off the diluted stream of thought, leaving not a drop behind. If you open your mouth, you are mistaken. If you doubt for a moment, you have missed the way. Tell me, what is the eye that has pierced the barriers? See the following. Main subject. Umon spoke to the assembly and said, everybody has his own light. If he tries to see it, everything is darkness. What is everybody's light? Later, in place of his disciples, he said, the halls and the gate. And again he said, blessing things cannot be better than nothing. Blessing things cannot be better than nothing. Sutro's verse, it illuminates itself, absolutely bright. He gives a clue to the secret. Flowers have fallen, trees give no shade. Who does not see if he looks? Seeing is non-seeing, non-seeing is seeing. Facing backward on the ox, he rides into the Buddha hall. Thank you all so much for doing such a wonderful job this morning with your practice. You know, we have a condensed schedule, a session schedule, because of our online operation. As most of you know, I came back from Wyoming with COVID, and I tested positive on Monday, so it wasn't possible for us to meet at Murray Grove as we were hoping to. And so we have a condensed schedule. Instead of getting up at, you know, basically 4:30 and getting into the Zendo by 5, we got into the Zendo at 7. And that means that, you know, people got a little bit more sleep, which is a plus and a minus, actually. Sometimes too much sleep is a problem at Sesshin. But, you know, the challenge is that we're doing all the sitting we would have done at Sesshin in a very condensed way. So basically, you know, we get up at 4:30, we get into the Zendo by 5, we do our chanting until 5:45, then we have a bathroom break, we have tea, and then we have a bathroom break, and 6 to 7:30 is our 3 morning periods of sitting. And then there's a bathroom break, and there's about 10 or 15 minutes until breakfast. And so the pace is, you know, more protracted, but it's a little bit looser. And the schedule we have now is really intense. It's like, you know, we're sitting all day long. And so, you know, if you do the 3 sits in the morning, and then we have almost 2 hours before the next sit, you know, your legs have a little chance to recover. But the way we're doing it here is pretty intense. And yet, you know, everybody is just doing a magnificent job. You know, people are sitting so still and so well, and people are coming into the Dokusan room and really opening their hearts, you know, opening their hearts. And it's really gratifying. It's wonderful to see people come alive on the cushion, you know. In the Mongkon, sometimes they'll say of a teacher that he's fanning like the embers, right? You know, so you know, the teacher is sort of like the coach, but also the teacher's trying to, it's like building a little fire if you're camping out, right? You have all this stuff on the ground and you're trying to get it to ignite, you know, and and maybe something, there's like a little spark, you know, and you're blowing on it, and then suddenly it just bursts into flames. And when that happens in the Dokusan room, it's absolutely thrilling. It's like, I mean, that's what I live for, really. And no, not really, that's what I live for, you know, is to see people come awake, see people come alive in the Dokusan room is worth anything, in my opinion. And people are doing that. People are coming alive in the Dokusan room. You know, even when they walk into the Dokusan room and they think they're dumbfounded and nothing's going on. You know, the conscious mind is always the last to know. You know, so yesterday I said, you know, the conscious mind is like the tip of the iceberg. It's just this superficial part of our intelligence. And the big mind is like the iceberg under the surface of the water. It's this vastness that underlies us all, right? And you know, so often, you know, things are happening, powerful things are happening, and the person involved doesn't know it, because the person involved is just, you know, repeating the turning phrase of the koan. And, you know, when the little mind looks around, it doesn't see anything. You know, but at the same time, there's this powerful transformation underway. Eventually, the little mind catches up. Eventually, the little mind notices, hey, something's happening. How come I feel so great, right? You know, I'm not answering my koan, but I feel wonderful. Or I'm not answering my koan, but it feels like my heart is breaking. Or I'm not answering my koan, but, you know, suddenly my fear is so obvious to me, or suddenly my fear has disappeared. You know, all of those are deep transformations, and the sort of clueless little mind is still thinking, well, there's got to be an answer to this koan somewhere, right? So when people come into the Dokusan room and they burst into flames, it's thrilling, but they don't always know why. They don't even know that it's happening, you know, sometimes. Sometimes they do, you know, but a couple people have had breakthroughs after many years of practice. You know, somebody came in and what happens in the Dokusan room is strictly confidential. I never talk about it to anybody, ever. And you should not either. You know, actually what we exchange in Dokusan is between you and me and your big mind, and my big mind, right? So there's really no reason to share that with others, right? But I don't think that people in this case will mind if I quote just brief portions of what was said. You know, one person said, you know, I have been practicing on and off for a long time, but I never realized that this was here. You know, this state of awareness is, you know, just basically unlike anything I have ever experienced. It's extraordinary. And, you know, to hear that from somebody's lips is really quite wonderful, right? It's like, yes, welcome. You know, it can take a while before people discover that, you know, that it's like toiling up a mountain. Right. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever, as you know, I like to hike, you know, and I've been an avid hiker since I was about 16 years old. And I like to hike out west because, you know, once you get up high, the vistas are extraordinary. But I used to hike in the Northeast and in the South, in the Shenandoah. And, you know, the thing about hiking in the Shenandoah is that it's delayed gratification to the point of no gratification, right? It's like, if you've ever hiked in the Shenandoah Mountains, it's like you're going up this mountain and you're surrounded by trees, and it's this very difficult, steep climb up this mountain. And then you get to the top of the mountain and there's no vista, there's just more trees, and then you go down the mountain. And it's like, well, where's the payoff, right? You know? So sometimes Zen practice feels like that, right? It's just this slog. And, you know, but what happens eventually is you go up one mountain and down the mountain, and then you go up the mountain and you go down the mountain. But one day, you know, you go up the mountain and you turn and there's the vista. There's that vista. And this person had that experience, right? The person said, this is extraordinary. You know, this is a person who's been practicing on and off for a while, but hadn't gotten to this place. And I said, you know, oh, I am so glad you found this. You know, so glad. Welcome. You know, and you know, the person said, you know, the problem for me getting started was just so much pain, right? You know, and it's true. You know, this is challenging on a lot of levels, and the physical challenge is significant. You know, but because there's a body-mind unity, you know, you should realize that when you have pain in your legs or in your back, you know, within reason, if you've suffered an injury, of course, that's a different thing. But, you know, you're also purifying your mind. So, you know, it's not the case that, you know, when you have physical discomfort, it has no relationship to your consciousness. Those two things are intimately interrelated. You know, and your relationship to your pain is a complicated matter, assuming you haven't been injured. But your relationship to your pain is really a very profound psychological challenge, right? You know, if we didn't have physical discomfort on the cushion, we would never escape from the orbit of ourselves. You know, so, you know, I can remember the first couple years of Zen practice, you know, just wanting to scream sometimes, right? It was just like it was just like a big toothache in my legs, right? But you know, I can also remember, you know, there was a sesshin that we had, if you know Washington State, out in Moses Lakes. It was this sesshin out in eastern Washington because we hadn't started building Tokuganji yet, our temple. And we rented this space out in Moses Lakes, and it was beautiful. At night, you know, you could hear the coyotes. It's like the West. It's like the, you know, not the Northwest, it's like the West. But you know, I was in so much pain day one, as usual, so much pain in day, and then something just snapped. And it was like all of a sudden my pain was gone. And I went in to see Genki Roshi and I said, you know, Genki Roshi, my pain is gone. I don't think I'll ever have pain again. He burst into laughter. He said, wait, you know, wait till tomorrow, you know, and it was back. But, you know, you get into this deep, deep state and your pain does disappear. You know, you could get into a place where it's like the eye of a tornado, right? It's like perfectly still, you know. At any rate, you know, pain is a challenge, physical pain, and different kinds of mental obstacles. These are all challenges. And, you know, but if you just hang in there, you know, you're slogging up the mountain and down the mountain and slogging up and say, where is the payoff? You know, but what happened to this person was, you know, this person said to me, I see the view, I see the vista. And that was extraordinary, you know, and it's worth any price, in my opinion. It's worth any price. And that's just the beginning. That's just the beginning. So that's wonderful. That takes a lot of sitting to do that. And not just at sesshin, although sesshin is indispensable, but it also takes, you know, it also takes daily practice, lots of daily practice. So then somebody else came in also into the Dokusan room and said, you know, somebody basically has been working with the Mu Koan, with emptiness koan, and said, you know, basically, I had no idea. You know, I had no, the person came in, and again, I don't think this person will mind if I quote. The person said, I've been saying moo, 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 moo. And suddenly I'm in a place that is no, it's just, it's no place, right? I'm in a place that's no place. And, you know, the person really didn't have words, but the realness of this was like stunning, right? It was stunning. And the person, it was like, suddenly I know, you know, I've heard you talk for 20 years about moo, you know, but suddenly I know now what moo is. And the person, you know, when this happens, this is like a, this is karmically transformative, right? Because now you know, you know, you've heard the concept, you've heard the concept a million times, but now you know. And when you have that kind of deep knowing, it's not intellectual. It's like, I've been to the mountaintop, I know. And that's karmically significant, right? Because that means, you know, you could walk away from that. You could walk away. You know, there's always something interesting on TV, you know. But you know, basically, you know in your heart that this is the path, right? You know in your heart that this is the path, you know. So when that kind of thing happens to people, you know, it doesn't happen at every sesshin. You know, sometimes sesshins, people are just struggling. You know, it's just struggling, struggling, struggling. When I first started teaching Zen in 1995, something like that, you know, I started doing sesshin on my own without Genki Roshi or Webb Roshi. And, you know, it just seemed like everything was going wrong. You know, people were coming in and saying, oh, I hate this, you know, I want to leave. And I just thought, gee, I must be the worst Zen teacher in the world, you know? But the interesting thing is, that, you know, if I didn't quit, you know, I hung in there, just like the student, right? The student doesn't quit, doesn't get in the car and go home. The student keeps going and the teacher keeps going, you know? And, you know, I remember this one session where it just seemed like everybody was falling apart. And then around day three, the most amazing thing happened. You know, I had laid awake at night thinking, oh my God, you know, I'm really like a failure as a Zen teacher. You know, everybody's coming in and they're mad and they're mad at me. One person actually came in and spit at me, you know. They were so mad, right? And I just thought, oh, but you know, I got up the next day, we sat, and then that night at Dzogchen, people came in, they were laughing, they were having a good time. People said, oh, this is wonderful. I had no idea, you know. I didn't make it happen, right? I didn't make it happen, and actually, they didn't make it happen. I didn't make it, the teacher doesn't make it happen, and the student doesn't make it happen. See, so who makes it happen? Who makes it happen? That's really kind of what this koan is about. Uman spoke, Uman, Yunmen, the great Yunmen. There were originally five houses of Zen, five different branches of Zen. One is Linji, one is Tsaotung, and one was Yunmen. Cloud Gate. There were two others also, but Uman had his own school, right? And even though it disappeared, you know, Joshu's school disappeared, even though Uman's school disappeared, you know, his koans are everywhere in the collection, and he's a great genius, really. You know, Uman spoke to the assembly and he said, everybody has his own light, but if he tries to see it, everything is darkness. What is everybody's light? Now look, no, this happens all the time in Yunmen's case. He'll ask a question to his students and nobody can answer. And he'll wait a minute and then he'll answer it himself. But the answer isn't any help either, right? So here, that happens here. He says, everybody has his own light, but if he tries to see it, all he gets is darkness. What is everybody's light? Later, because none of the disciples could say, he said, the halls and the gate. See, not any help if you don't already know. And then he said, blessing things cannot be better than nothing. See, so even if you're blessing things, that's inferior. The way of blessings is inferior to the way of emptiness. So this koan is just getting more and more confusing. Let me read you one other thing. This is about the one of the great Zen teachers, not Umon, but Umon's great 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 Dharma grandfather, and his name was Matsu, ancestor horse. Really one of the most important people in the development of Chan, of Zen in China. And this is from the biography of Matsu. Leaving Sichuan for central China, Matsu spent several years engaged in the practice of sitting meditation. A spiritual turning point came during a solo meditation retreat at Chuanfa Monastery, where he had a life-changing encounter with the seventh ancestor. During this period in Chinese history, it was common for solo and group meditation retreats to last for up to 60 days. Yes, if you think 5 days is tough, think about that, 60 days, right? Up to 60 days with a daily regimen. Now look, we do 8 or 9 hours a day. That's like any temple in Japan, basically. We can hold our heads up, right? But 16 to 18 hours a day of sitting meditation and maybe 3 to 4 hours of chanting and sutra recitation. Okay, wow. So anyway, Matsu is thriving in this. He's sitting. And one day, he's sitting in the Zendo extra hours. He's not doing enough sitting. So he's in the, and he hears this scraping right outside where he's sitting. It's like somebody's scraping a rock or something. And he's trying to ignore it. Finally, he can't ignore it. And who should be outside but the master, right? Who should be outside but the seventh ancestor? And the seventh ancestor has a roof tile, and he's scraping the roof tile. And Matsu says, "What are you doing scraping that roof tile?" And the seventh ancestor says, "I'm trying to make it a mirror." And Matsu says, "But you could scrape and polish it forever, but it will never turn into a mirror." And the seventh ancestor says, exactly. See, so you know, this story is often misunderstood. People understand this story to mean that the seventh ancestor was telling Matsu, you don't have to do all this Zen practice, you're already awakened. But that's not the message of the sutra. I mean, of the story. Because look, the seventh ancestor is the one who is organizing the 60-day retreat. So he didn't say to Matsu, don't even bother, it's all bullshit. You can just sit, you know, and you're already enlightened. He didn't say that. What he said was, you're practicing in the wrong way. You're trying to make it happen. Don't try to make it happen. Trust the process. See, let big mind do it. All you have to do is get on board and go for the ride. See, go for the ride. So he didn't say don't practice. That's a misunderstanding. What he said is don't practice the way you're practicing. You are trying to make it happen. Don't try to make it happen. Trust the process. All you have to do is go into deep mood, show up for Sesshin, number one. All you have to do is practice. And then number two, all you have to do is sit down on the cushion and go into empty mind. See, and number three, trust your big mind. And the, if you just keep emptying yourself out and you're sitting on the cushion and you don't get in your car and drive away, etc., something is going to happen. The big mind is going to activate, see. And it will activate on its own timetable. It will activate on its own timetable. You know, I can remember when I was a very diligent Zen student. I was not very successful, but I was really committed. And I was sitting, and I came into Genki Roshi, and I could not answer the Mu Koan. I had this dream. We had this retreat, and I had this dream where the wall suddenly turned into the Buddha. And I saw the Buddha in the wall, and I woke up, and I went to Genki Roshi, and I said, "Genki Roshi, I've had a dream. I saw the Buddha in the wall." And I thought that was the answer to the Mu Koan. And he said, "That's just a dream." And I said, "Oh, I'm so discouraged. You know, I'm sitting, I go to the Zen Center every morning, every night, you know, and all these other people are answering their koans and I can't even get to square one." And Genki Roshi said, "You can't make it happen. But if you don't try, nothing happens, right? If you don't show up, nothing happens. But when you show up, you can't make it happen. You have to trust the big mind, the trust, one with the trusting mind, trust the process." See? And, you know, it could take 10 years or a day to answer your koan. It's not in your control. It's not in your control. So that sounds like bad news, right? We like to be in control. But notice, you know, these koans are so they set us up, right? Every koan has at least one hook. And by that is, every koan traps you into one kind of misconception or another to test your insight, to help you work your way out. And the first trap in this koan isn't even the koan. It's in Engo's one ooze introduction. Engo's introduction is, look, controlling the world, he allows not the least speck of dust to escape, see? He cuts off the diluted stream of thought, leaving not a drop behind. Who wouldn't want to be that guy, right? Who wouldn't want to be that guy, right? Controlling the world, you know, we'll sit on the cushion and we'll control the world. I'll allow not a speck to escape. Perfect control at all times, right? That is not Zen. That is not Zen. See, this is all setting you up. He's just playing a game. He's toying with you like a string with a cat, right? He cuts off the diluted stream of thought, leaving not a drop behind. If you open your mouth, you are mistaken. If you doubt for a moment, you've missed the way. Well, that's not Zen practice. Zen practice is not knowing, right? You're just blundering along. But the good news is, you know, there's a good news too, right? Everybody has his own light. Everybody has her own light. It's all the same light, but we all have it. We all have it. So, you know, it takes a lot of guts to practice Zen. You know, it's easier just to say, "Well, I'm already enlightened, I don't have to practice." And that's a, if I may say so, that's a fool's paradise. Probably Trump believes that, or George W. Bush Jr., right? So that's a fool's paradise. But we could do it, you know, we'll spend, in our quest for wisdom, we'll spend 5 hours a day watching television, that kind of thing. So if we don't do that, if we say, "Actually, this is not the way," and we begin to practice, then we've put our whole life on the line. You know, we can practice half-heartedly. We can practice in an on and off way, because that's a way of hedging our bets, right? If we put too many of our chips on this, we might lose the bet, right? We might, you know. But if we practice wholeheartedly, you know, that takes real courage. You know, this is my path. And it may or may not, quote unquote, work out, right? So the literature of Zen is filled with people who have been practicing for 30 years. Like, there's a koan about an old monk who's been there for 30 years and he hasn't had Daikensho. right? And Zhou Za, I forget what Zhou Za is in Mandarin, but he's an elder, he's like a senior monk, basically. And he's been there for 30 years, but, and you know, the literature of Zen is filled with such people, right? So we make a commitment, you know, then we say, you know, will this pay off, right? And that's a way of making ourselves miserable, right? Making ourselves miserable. And it's actually like not a good way to practice. You know, everybody has Buddha nature, and Buddha nature is helping us all wake up all the time in countless ways. You know, how did you even get here, right? How did you even get some word, you heard some word at some point, or you read something and it resonated. You know, and that resonate that you forgot about the article, but the resonating vibration went on and on and magnified, and finally you're here today practicing the Great Way. And even though we all have these moments where we're thinking, this is never going to happen, what the hell am I doing? I don't, you know, people go through that at every session, right? You know, around day three of session, people are thinking, what the hell am I doing? Why am I playing these stupid games? But then all of a sudden there's like an opening, and you think, how did that happen? Sometimes people go into the Dokusan room and they present an answer which is like the perfect answer. It's like the arrow just goes straight to the target. And they don't know. They don't know. I'll say, that's a perfect answer. You know, it's like their big mind is far in advance of their little mind. They don't know yet, but they will. They will. And it may not be at that session. It may be 10 years later, they're going to come into the Dokusan room and say, oh my God, this is what you were talking about. You know, but to practice Zen is not to be a warrior. It's not to be super strong. It's not to be ever vigilant, although vigilance is good. It's to live on trust, to live on trust. You know, you put yourself in the hands of your big mind, even though you don't know what your big mind is, and you say, please guide me to awakening. And you go to Sesshin, right? You practice the way, and you live, that's your life. And that's the, in my opinion, the most beautiful life, to live on trust. I don't know if you've ever seen, I don't have it here, the visual aid, but you know, there's a wonderful painting. There's a guy, Morris Graves. He's a painter from Seattle. He painted in the 50s. But he has this painting. He practiced Zen. He was, you know, Zen practice. He has this painting called Blind Bird. Right? And it's a painting of a little bird who has these big eyes and they're black because he's blind. And you think, oh my God, a blind bird, what chance does a blind bird have in hell, right? But you know, to practice Zen, we all have to be like a blind bird, right? We all have to live on trust, the trusting mind. You know, and in my opinion, that's the most beautiful way to live. You know, it's so hard, it takes so much courage to just trust the process of life, right? Because you know, that life doesn't always seem to, you know, doesn't always seem to be delivering for us. But maybe that's because life has a bigger plan. But I'm back. Back, right? Yes, back? Okay, good. Controlling the world, he allows not the least speck of dust to escape. He cuts off the diluted stream of thought, leaving not a drop behind. He cuts off the, if you open your mouth, you are mistaken. If you doubt for a moment, you have missed the way. See, this is all not true. None of this is true. Tell me, what is the eye that has pierced the three barriers? See the following. Umon spoke to the assembly and he said, everybody has his own light. If he tries to see it, everything is darkness. When we try to see it, everything is darkness. Because that's when the little mind looks, all it ever sees, when it looks, the little mind looks into the big mind, all it ever sees is darkness. And it says, oh my God, there's nothing there. But the big mind looks dark to the little mind because it's vast, right? And the little mind can't understand. So what is everybody's light? Nobody can answer yet, but they will. They'll answer. They'll know. Later, in place of the disciples, he said, the halls and the gate. The halls and the gate. You are the hall. You are the gate. You are the hall. You are the gate. Every morning we say, Atadipa. Atadipa. You are the light. You are the light. Setro's verse. It illuminates itself. The great mind is working in every one of us to wake up, to bring us to awakening. It illuminates itself, absolutely bright. He gives a clue to the secret. Flowers have fallen, trees give no shade. Who does not see if he looks? Seeing is non-seeing, non-seeing is seeing. Facing backward on the ox, he rides into the Buddha hall. That is how people walk into awakening, right? We're riding the ox backward, right? And basically all we see are all the koans we didn't answer or all our screw-ups. And so all we see is like the mistakes. But all the time the ox, the big mind, is taking us towards enlightenment, see? All we see is our confusion, but we're unstoppably going to awakening, see? So let's keep unstoppably, let's keep getting confused and unstoppably going towards awakening, please.